I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. The Women's March on Washington brought an estimated 500,000 people to the nation's capital on Saturday. There were rallies and marches in other cities, including here in Philadelphia, where some 50,000 people showed up in front of the Art Museum. Emily Cooper Morse was the lead organizer of the Philadelphia March, thinking that there would be a small gathering when she posted a notice on Facebook shortly after the election of Donald Trump. We're going to be talking about the march and what happens next, how to turn dissent into meaningful and lasting change. And we begin our conversation with Emily Cooper Morse, who lives and works here in the Philadelphia area. And Emily, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's very nice to be on Radio Times. I'm a huge fan of yours, Marty.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Well, let me ask you, Emily, what were you thinking when you looked out at that sea of faces, that crowd of an estimated 50,000 people on Saturday?
I was thrilled. It is what I wanted from the very beginning, was to have, a large crowd of people to be able to come together, to connect with each other, and to hopefully connect with some of the speakers and that we had, worked on getting for the rally portion of the day, and hopefully connect with some of their messaging and maybe take away something new that they hadn't thought of before. So I was absolutely thrilled. We were hoping to have 20 to 30,000 people, even about 2 days before the march and rally. So to have that surge of an additional 20,000 people or so was just absolutely amazing for our entire team. We were just on a complete high the entire evening.
Have you ever done anything like this before?
No, actually. I work in supply chain for a chemical manufacturer in King of Prussia, where I also live. But this was something that was really important to me. And so I wanted to kind of create an event in solidarity with the Women's March on Washington. And like you said, I was hoping, hey, maybe I can get a few hundred people in a park in Philadelphia and we can just be there in solidarity. And it just really took off from there. And I was very fortunate to meet people along the way, and then also my friend Beth Finn, who sits on the chair for the Race for Hope in Philly, decided to join the team. And so she was a huge asset because the Race for Hope up until last year was on the parkway. I had, Amy Martin, who was with me from the very beginning, who started as just helping me with adminning the page, and that's how I met her. But she has nonprofit experience and just logistics and management experience. And so the group just grew over time, and we were really able to all use our different skill sets, none of us having pulled off something this large before, but made it work. So
how much of your time was taken up with getting porta potties and fences and, all the things that you need when 50,000 people get together?
The porta potties are really, really important. People don't realize how important porta potties are to people. So a lot of it had to do with our fundraising. So we organized our budget by line item and then by priority. So the first priority were the city fees that we had to pay. We didn't have to pay for permitting and things of that nature, other than the $20 application fee, because it's a first right amendment. But we do have to pay for the electricians and plumbing and things like that to come out. So that was the first priority. And then, we had to pay for insurance, which we were required to have. And then up next was porta potties. So as we, fundraised, we were able to add on each line item that we had enough money for. So eventually we had enough, for jumbotrons and an AV system and things like that. And we were very fortunate to have a staging company from Pittsburgh called Fly Space Productions that donated their stage and manpower and everything to us. So that really helped defray a lot of the cost
Emily, what did it cost to host this march and rally on Saturday?
I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but I think we were able to pull it off for approximately $50,000 to $60,000.
Does that surprise you? Did that seem like a reasonable price to pay for the march and rally?
Yes, because originally we had budgeted a ballpark figure of around $100,000. So a lot of the vendors were willing to work with us because we are a grassroots movement. And I think because a lot of them believed in the cause and what we were marching for. And, you know, slowly but surely, we were able to raise a lot of the money. It was completely grassroots. We had a couple of people that were that donated larger amounts. But I mean, yeah, we were it was very nice to have such a supportive community of people willing to come together and help us.
One of the things that you said when you spoke to the crowd was that you were a survivor of sexual assault. And I wonder just how difficult that was for you to go public with something like that.
It was very difficult at first. It's something that for years only my close friends and family knew about. And I talked about it a few weeks ago at one of our gatherings, and we had a meet and greet at the City Tap House, and I decided to talk about it to the crowd as that being one of my motivating factors for starting this, because it is. And I had one of the women that were in attendance come up and tell me how much it meant to her for me to talk about that. And so since then, you know, I spoke briefly at Daylin Leach's Resistance Forum last week, and I mentioned it again, and I had probably seven women come up to me and thank me for sharing that. And so it was important to me to incorporate that into my speech for that day, because I want other survivors to know that they don't need to be afraid of that stigma, that there's other survivors out there that, you know, are here for you and can talk to you. And so I had even more women on the day of, after my speech, thank me for sharing that part of my speech. And so to me, it was really important that they can see that one, an ordinary person can do this. So now you don't have any excuse not to get involved and do something. You don't have to host a march for 50,000 people, but you can certainly, you know, call your legislators or have a postcard making party or something like that. But also, I think it's important to kind of build that community that we're starting to build, where we're comfortable about talking about some of our struggles together.
Did you also say that because of Donald Trump's bragging on a bus with Billy Bush?
Yes, that's exactly why. It was something that during the election, and I was never, I mean, even back to The Apprentice, couldn't stand Donald Trump, but I mean, as my president, especially not. And when those tapes were released, and he didn't even apologize, really, and then excused it away as locker room talk. And I have a lot of men in my life and a lot of men that are very honest with me about, you know, their behavior. And all of the men in my life were appalled by those tapes. And so as a survivor of sexual assault, to excuse even just the description, whether he did it or not, you know, we don't know, but to discuss it and excuse it as away as locker room talk is completely unacceptable. And as the president of the United States, he is an example for our children, for boys and girls alike. And so they'll know about those tapes when they get older. And so it was important to me to speak out against that and not normalize that behavior.
Were you surprised to see so many pink hats at the rally on Saturday?
No, I wasn't surprised. Everyone was very excited about the pink hats. So I did not wear a pink hat, but only because I'm just not a knitter, and I also didn't have enough time to, to get one ahead of time, to, you know, to make one ahead of time. But no, it was a movement that a lot of people were excited about. And one of our team members, Rachel, she made one in her spare time, which I don't even know how, because she was in charge of all of the transportation logistics and a lot of the ADA accommodations that we made. So, but she had her pink hat on, and I thought that was great.
So what happens next for you? And as you are telling us, this was sort of a, not exactly a surprise movement, but certainly the size of the event in Saturday was a surprise. So what happens to this movement? What happens to you next?
So we actually founded a nonprofit called Philly Women Rally. One, because it made sense logistically for things like insurance and liability and things like that to host the march, but also because we had long-term goals of, we don't want this to be a one-day event. We actually want this to be a kickoff event to things that we want to do in the Philadelphia area and its suburbs. And so the team, it's funny, when we all kind of were wrapping up on Saturday, we were like, okay, guys, we're all exhausted. I don't think any of us got more than a couple of hours of sleep the night before. And we said, let's take, you know, a couple days off, and we'll talk, you know, in the middle of this week. And Saturday night, we were all in bed texting each other. And we could do this next, and we could do this next. And then we're like, okay, seriously, let's take a break. And then all day Sunday, we were texting and emailing again about all the ideas that we have. So finally, we decided we need to meet in person. So the team is actually coming over to my house on Saturday, and we're going to have a several hour brainstorming session where we nail down the mission statement of our nonprofit, which is Philly Women Rally. And then we're going to talk about next steps. And, you know, Amy Martin, who's one of our, who I mentioned, just texted me right before the show and said, oh, what if one of our first, you know, get togethers, like follow up events, we host a postcard making party, because that seems to be something that a lot of our marchers are bringing up and are interested in doing. So that might be something that you see in the next week or two, that we throw together and find a space for people to come out and do it together and come together again. So, but yeah, we have so many plans. And right now, so Javita Hill, who is the executive director for the Commission for Women in Philadelphia, is collecting toiletries and feminine products and things like that for recent survivors of sex trafficking. So Amy and I are both working on collecting donations in our area. She lives in Abington. I live in King of Prussia. And then we've also provided the drop-off location to our followers on our social media pages. And then I'm going to do a very large drop-off on Friday, February 3rd.
You know,
that's
what, Emily?
I
hate to do this. You're a busy girl.
Oh,
thank you for joining us today on Radio
thank
Time.
Thank you so much.
Emily Cooper Morse, organizer of the Philadelphia Women's March, playing that song, meaning we're up on a break. We've got two more guests waiting in the wings talking more about what next. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. There were about 1,000 people who participated in the Queer Rager protest dance party outside the Lowe's Hotel in Center City, Philadelphia last night, where Republicans are holding their strategy session. President Trump is scheduled to arrive in the city sometime today. This is less than a week after millions met and marched in cities across the country to protest Trump and his policies. Anti-abortion activists are holding their 44th annual March for Life in Washington, D.C. tomorrow on Friday. Today on Radio Times, how to turn dissent into meaningful political and social change. We have two guests who have joined us. Becky Bond is the author of Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. She served as senior advisor on the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, was an architect of the campaign's national volunteer-driven grassroots campaign. And Becky Bond, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
great to be here, Marty.
Also with us, in fact, joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Kianga Yamada Taylor. She's author of Black Lives Matter. Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She's an assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University, where she writes on race, social movements, and Black politics. And Kianga, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Kianga, you and I were talking before going on the air. You said you went to the protest in 2000 when President Bush became the president of the United States. You were also in Washington, D.C. on Saturday. What was the difference?
Well, the difference was night and day. That the Bush protests in 2000, there may have been 10, 15, at the absolute maximum, 20,000 people there. This past Saturday's march was so large, it was almost frightening because there was physically no place to move. But at the same time, it was incredibly heartening. There were thousands of handmade signs. You could see that regular people got themselves, found a way to get themselves to Washington, D.C. To register their opposition, even disgust with this new administration. I was saying before that, I was joking with a friend of mine that Trump's speech, his inaugural address the day before, probably mobilized another 500,000 people on the East Coast. It was so dark and ominous and foreboding. And so I think that these are the constitutive elements of the grassroots movement that needs to be organized to confront Trump.
Becky, let me ask you a similar question, but frame it slightly differently. What do you think the message was from the protests in D.C. and all the protests in the other cities across the country? We'll leave the world aside. Let's focus on the United States. But what was the message from the women marching?
Well, the women's marches showed that there are millions of people in this country who want to radically change the direction that we're headed. And what's more, the way that these marches were organized, and Professor Taylor is exactly right, these are profoundly different than any marches that we've seen organized against a leader. They showed that people are just waiting to be asked to do something big because these marches, they were organized by volunteers. They weren't centralized in the same way that a large NGO would do it if they were organizing a big protest. And that's why we had 600 of them with millions of people marching, run by volunteers who, like Emily, who you had on earlier on the show, are not going away. They're here to stay. And we're going to have a new crop of leaders that are going to be leading this fight against this new administration.
Can you have, though, to you, Becky, and also to you, Kianga, can you have a decentralized movement that affects the kind of change that people are calling for? Becky?
So I'm sure Professor Taylor will have, who studied social movements, will have a lot to
sure.
say about this. Having served on the Bernie Sanders campaign, I would say absolutely that this is a moment where you can have a decentralized movement all doing work often towards a centralized plan. And because we have so many software tools and social media platforms where people can connect not just to leaders of a movement but to each other, we have the ability to make our protests and to make the hard work of actually changing out the leaders of our government. We have the potential for so many more people to be involved in that. And I'll just give you one example. We're seeing, after the executive orders that were announced yesterday, we're seeing groups call for a radical expansion or understanding of the sanctuary movement in the United mm-hmm. States to be something which is not just about cities protecting immigrants from deportation, but about everything from homes to businesses to campuses to cities, protecting everyone from immigrants to non-immigrants, Muslims to political dissidents, to Black people under attack. And this can be something that someone can do everywhere, but also link up to a campaign that's led by volunteer leaders or by a group like Mi Gente. And I think we'll see this in lots of different dimensions happening across the country.
Well, let me put several things to you, Kianga. One is, and it's interesting, Becky worked with the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, raising the question whether you need if not Bernie Sanders, a Bernie Sanders, somebody to sort of represent what a movement is. And do movements have to pick one thing, one issue? Does it work that way?
We don't actually have the luxury to pick one issue. Trump has laid out in what initially was called Donald Trump's contract with America that sort of laid out his plans for the first 100 days and now have become essentially his policy platform, has put almost everyone in the crosshairs of this administration. And so this isn't about picking one issue. This is about trying to find ways to weave together multiple issues in such a way as we get people who are directly involved in particular campaigns to see the relationship and connection between those particular struggles with a larger fight in what is increasingly becoming identified as the Trump resistance. And so I think that it means that we can have decentralization in that there will be local campaigns that are focused on the most important issues of that area. So, for example, in the Midwest Plain states, it might be a focus on the anti-pipeline protest. In Chicago, the focus may be on police brutality, but also defense against deportations. Elsewhere, there might be a focus on abortion rights. And so the issue, to me, that represents a decentralization, but what we have to find ways are to centralize experiences, centralize tactics, centralize the different representations of campaigns into national vehicles so that movements can generalize their experiences, can be in communication with each other, so we can figure out how then we focus on particular things that come up that need to have a concentration of forces and resources.
But do you think there are lessons to be learned from the anti-abortion movement? And they have been very successful in making it, adding regulations in many states across this country, making it more difficult for women to access abortion and in some cases even family planning services. They have put a lot of pressure on legislatures and they have changed a lot of the regulations.
I think that in some ways it's a dubious example. I think that these are people that have mouthpieces already existing in Congress who sort of reflect their own point of view. And if anything, the relationship between the two have worked to distort the discussion around access to abortion. And I think that the Democratic Party in particular and the constant willingness to hedge and to compromise and to refuse to take clear, definitive stances have really helped to marginalize the voices of pro-abortion and pro-choice supporters, who I still believe are the majority in this country. And the anti-abortion pro-life misnamed pro-life movement, I think, show the advantage that those reactionary forces have when they have these mouthpieces that are in Congress and now in the White House. I don't think that is our example. Our example is from the grassroots and really connecting with an existing sentiment that is for social justice but is often muffled and marginalized because often our movements get wound up in the Democratic Party machine and that message gets muted.
Well, let me pick up on that and let me toss that to you, Becky. Having worked with the Bernie Sanders campaign, how much do you think whatever this movement is or whatever it becomes needs to ally itself with a party, and probably in this case it would be the Democratic Party, of the two mainstream parties? How important is that, do you think?
Well, what we have here is we don't have a minority that needs innovative tactics and resources in order to take control. That's the other side of what they did. We represent the majority of the people who didn't want Donald Trump to be the president, who choose democracy over fascism, who believe that this country should be for all of us. And I think the question right now is, does the Democratic Party want to stand with the majority of the people? Because that's what's going to take to build a majority representing us in elected office. And what we saw, I think, in this election is there's a serious crisis in competency at the highest levels of the Democratic Party, where you had a presidential candidate who, despite winning the popular vote and having every advantage, they ran a campaign that just collapsed and that actually didn't do some of the very basic thing that a campaign tends to do. And now it's back to us, right? And it's I've never seen intellectuals like Professor Taylor, political professionals like myself, and people new to politics like the organizers of the Philly Women's March and women's march across the country aligned in an effort to take back our country. And when it comes to the Democratic Party, we need people across the country to not leave it up to the party leaders, not leave it in their care to run the campaigns that can bring the majority of the people to vote for representatives who will represent us. That's on all of us to get involved. And in fact, you know, this is already happening. I've been involved with a bunch of volunteers in an effort which is called Knock Every Door, and it's at knockeverydoor.org. And the idea behind Knock Every Door is volunteers going out in their communities, organizing themselves and their friends, especially going out into these communities that voted for President Obama in 2012, but voted for President Trump in 2016. And there are people doing this in Pennsylvania. And what's interesting about Pennsylvania is, you know, Pennsylvania is going to hold elections in 2017. And there are still a few months for people who are listening to this broadcast to decide to run for office. Pennsylvania is going to elect election judges and election inspectors, the people that actually run the elections and can make sure that people who are eligible can cast a ballot that counts. And so I think it's up to us not to take over the party, but actually to make the party be responsive to the people, get involved in the process, start talking to voters, start running for office, and do the work starting now to make sure that we don't have the outcome of 2016 in 2017, in 2018, and 2020.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Again, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Let me get Tracy from South Philadelphia to join our conversation. Tracy, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
I just want to say I love your show. And,
thanks.
You know, I'm a transgendered woman who lives in Philadelphia. However, I'm a Trump supporter, and I really don't understand why people are so zealous towards me and want to ostracize me when I already suffer from discrimination already.
You're saying people have attacked you, Tracy?
Yeah, verbally, but it's just and emotionally, which is just as bad as violently, physically. I'm afraid to talk about or negotiate, the topics, because when I do, I get, attacked emotionally and yelled at and, ostracized. And, I just don't understand. Are the leaders going to try to make that easier for more dialect for someone like me? And I'll tell you, I've been around this city for a long time, and I've suffered great discrimination, and I don't see anything changing. I see a lot of elitism and a lot of, like, this is my clique, and you're not welcome.
Sure.
Well,
Tracy,
I just wish we could just all get along.
Well, Tracy,
I love your show.
No, thank
love
you very much. I appreciate the call. Let me toss that to Kienga, and we could do, a whole hour about, and we probably will, and we certainly have in the past, about, so how do we talk to each other when we see things so differently?
Well, I think it there's one thing talking, and I wrote about this in an article for The Guardian about the need within the movement itself for people to figure out on what points do we agree and can we move forward, where do we disagree but are able to have productive conversations about it. I think some of the political hostility to Trump followers, in some ways is justified. Here is a political candidate who has bragged about sexually assaulting women, who is openly contemptuous and racist towards non-white people, who compared Mexicans to drug dealers and rapists, who has created a dystopic caricature of black life in this country, has referred to black communities as crime infested. I mean, the list could go on, and who has now put into power people who want to relitigate LGBTQ rights in this country. And so I think the hostility that Trump supporters in urban areas are feeling is because this man and the people surrounding him represent a threat to our very existence. I think the way that Trump's existence has legitimized white supremacists who feel confident about organizing out in the open, that this is not just a political debate, that this is really about people's survival.
Mm. Even though Tracy says, I'm transgender and I'm a Trump supporter.
Yeah, I mean, that is an almost incoherent contradiction, because Trump will actually be championing policies that will make Tracy's life much more complicated and harder. And you know, that's a position that needs to be rethought.
We're almost up on a break here, Becky. How important is just basic voting? And we know that our levels of voting in this country, no matter who you vote for, is relatively low compared to other democracies. Becky? I can hear something, but I can't hear Becky. Well, I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about a whole bunch of things in this hour of Radio Times, talking about the protests, marches, and rallies on Saturday, how to turn dissent into meaningful political and social change. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Kiyenga Yamada Taylor, and she's the author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. She's an assistant professor in the Department of African American Studies at Princeton University. We'll check in with Becky Bond joining us by telephone. Wrote a book called Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowang, talking with Kiyenga Yamada Taylor, and again, also with Becky Bond. And we are talking about how to turn grassroots movements into movements that move beyond a particular march or a particular rally. And you can join our conversation by calling us at 1-888-477-9499. A couple of comments here. One from Kimberly. I live in Pottstown and marched in D.C. Many of us across the country have and are taking individual actions that include writing and calling our congresspeople. A comment from Peter. It's very easy to become a committee person or precinct leader. They can reform the party from the inside and from the outside. I wonder to you, Kiyenga, just how you see political parties, and we have many of them. We have got the two mainstream parties, and they're different, they're similar, they operate in, you know, similar worlds. Is that where people that are interested in change, where people should focus their energy and efforts?
I guess I think that we're in a political moment where this is an opportunity to talk about a different kind of party, and perhaps the formation of a third party. Because I think that the idea that we can reform the Democratic Party from the inside out is not a new idea. It's a very old idea. And it's an idea that has not worked, and that the Democratic Party in many ways has perfected its ability to absorb its critics from the left without really changing much about how the party itself functions. We certainly saw this at the end of the 1960s, where the party literally changed its rules to allow for the incorporation of more women, of more young people, and of more African Americans. And the result was a sort of physically more diverse party, but the outcome in terms of actually championing policies that benefit the vast majority of people, that raise the standard of living for the vast majority of people in this country, that stand for racial justice, that has not changed. And in fact, that we've seen a Democratic Party, as it becomes more diverse, actually politically become more conservative over the last 40 years. And I think what the Sanders campaign represented, 13 million people who voted for an open socialist, is that people do want radical change. And the question is whether or not that radical change can be found in a party that is as craven and deeply committed to corporate America, to the capitalist economy in this country, as the Democratic Party is.
Becky, let me get you to weigh in on that. And then we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. I mean, interestingly, this is not the first time it's been said. Bernie Sanders, who certainly is has socialist leanings, but he did run as a Democrat. He didn't run on the Socialist Workers Party. It would have been an interesting experiment to see how well he would have done. But how do you see the parties and working inside, working outside? And I'm thinking also of the Tea Party. You know, they've been able to make inroads within the Republican Party.
Right. We have a two-party system, and I think the success of the Bernie Sanders campaign showed that there are millions of people in this country that have been left out by the Democratic Party. And Professor Taylor is exactly right that the party, has not been at the vanguard of fighting for economic or racial justice, and that's in part because they're captured by Wall Street and by the corporate elites, and they really decided. Actually to ally themselves really with both parties with the 1%. And that's left a lot of people out. When you had a candidate go out there and talking about all of the issues, right, and talking about a movement that everyone can participate in and can fight for change that will actually materially change their lives, the economic recovery in this country, has left most working Americans out. And neither party is addressing that. The Tea Party is a really interesting example because it's not a party like the Democratic Party or the Republican Party, but it is an expression of values that people can unite behind and say, I am a Tea Party Republican. And it's allowed them to actually make real change in Washington, D.C. And I think that politicians and voters and people who are not voting need to stand up. And whether it's a candidate like Bernie Sanders or whether they're saying, we want a country that actually, pursues practical solutions to climate change and to dismantling structural racism, which will be quite radical because the only practical way to deal with these issues is to deal with them massively all at once and immediately, then I think we'll see a lot more people want to get involved in the process, and we'll have to see the party leaders will have to chase these voters and have to be responsive. But it all starts with people starting to ask for something big and bring more people into the process. I think if we learned anything during the Bernie Sanders campaign, that people were willing to do something big, to win something big, but when politicians ask them to do something small to win something small, they see that it's not worth their time.
I was reading about Alice Paul. This was the Women's March for Women's Voting Rights. She chained herself to the White House as a form of protest, which, of course, raises the question to both of you and to our listeners, which is just how far are people willing to go for the things that they believe in? I mean, there are people that have done much more dramatic things, but I just thought timing-wise, it's interesting to think about someone like an Alice Paul.
Well, I think that we're going to find that out very quickly because in some sense we are up against it. Like I said initially, Trump is very clearly laying out his plans to attack not just different groups of people, but our very, basic standard of living. If you look at the cabinet appointments, These are people who are going to be engaged in a smash and grab operation. And so we are going to find out what people are willing to do in terms of organizing to confront this. And I think that the millions of people who came out to protest are a good indication. Last night in New York City, thousands of people came out to protest Trump's announcement of new rules regarding immigration. And so I think there's already been a call for a march on Washington for LGBT people this summer during the Pride weekend. And so I think that people are just beginning to figure out what the first 100 days will look like. And so we have to go from not just the marching, but now we have to shift into to organizing and to being in communication with each other and really transforming this political moment into a political movement.
Is the goal with protests to then change legislation to force people who write our laws to think twice?
To me, I think that's part of it. I think part of it certainly is forcing the people who politically to govern this country to be responsive to ordinary people. Absolutely. But I also think that we have to think bigger than that, that this is not just about policy. When we're talking about a radical redistribution of wealth and resources in this country, then we're talking about something that runs much deeper than just this or that policy. But I do think that the policy questions and our ability to hold people accountable and not transfer that to elected representatives, because I think that we've already seen in a very short time that the Democratic Party will cave on anything. Elizabeth Warren was shaking her fist in Boston on Saturday at the Women's March that we will not relent. And on Tuesday, she is voting to affirm Ben Carson as Secretary of HUD. It's so classic. It's so classic. And this is why we can't rely on these people to create the type of change that we need to move forward.
Let me get some callers in. A quick couple of comments here from Joan. If the Democrats continue with their neoliberal agenda, they will lose elections or continue to lose elections. A comment from John. What to do now? This is what I'm doing. Stay in frequent contact with congressmen and senators. Set up and participate in an indivisible chapter. Keep up to date on the news from the quote-unquote resistance and take a firearm safety course. Not sure about number four there. Let me get Carol from Cherry Hill, New Jersey, to join our conversation. Carol, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you. It seems that lobbying is the only way to get things done in Washington, and I was wondering if grassroots organizations can use their resources to professionally lobby the issues we want into to the legislators, and how can we, the public, donate our resources towards this method of making policy changes? I mean, marches are good, and you spend money on transportation and other things to get there, buy a hat or make a hat. I would like my money to go to someone who will, lobby the legislators and actually make the change happen. So I was just wondering how we know where to donate to.
Sure, Carol. Well, I don't want to tell you where to donate your money, but I think lobbying is interesting to talk about. Becky, what do you think about that? And it is true that a number of nonprofits and probably considered to be grassroots organizations, they don't have the money of a lot of these lobbyists, but there is some lobbying going on. Is that a fruitful way to think?
Well, so what's great about your caller is she's thinking structurally, right? And she's thinking, they have lobbyists, and that helps them, get what they want, get the corporate deals cut. But at the heart of lobbying is actually lobbyists move money to elected officials that elected officials use to stay in office. So, the only thing that an elected official will really respond to is the threat of losing his or her job. And so, what the other side has is a lot of money, and they give money to the candidates. We have people, right? And what we have to do is we have to organize voters to challenge the Democrats as well as the Republicans who are in elected office. And the only way they'll change how they're voting on this legislation is if they think that they have to vote that way to keep their jobs. And so what this means, I think, is actually, you know, when we give money to the nonprofit lobbyists in Washington, D.C., a lot of them are organizations that actually don't get involved in elections. So they're trying to make a persuasive case based on the issues, but the other side is saying, we'll help you keep your job if you do what we want. And if you don't do what we want, we're gonna replace you with someone who will. So I think we have to play hardball. And the great thing about that is we still have elections, right? We still get to replace our leaders through a political process. Now, that process is rigged against the people and for the corporate interests and for the incumbents who are in office. So it means, you know, we can't just win with 50% plus one. We generally have to get 55% to overcome all the people that are blocked from voting, et cetera. But I think we really do need to take elections far more seriously. And people who march need to understand they also need to go out and knock on doors. They also need to encourage people to run for office. And then they need to work for good people who run, including challenging Democrats, right? Because we saw from Bernie Sanders, who went from 3% name recognition to 46% of the delegates at the Democratic National Committee, which was done not through big corporate donations, big money fundraisers, but was done from hundreds of thousands of people getting involved in volunteering and literally millions of people giving small dollar donations, that even though we didn't win the nomination, the Bernie Sanders campaign changed the platform of the Clinton campaign as she went into the general election. So I think that even when we lose, we win when we challenge our elected officials. And this gets back not just to working and donating, but some people who march, they need to run for office. And let me just say right now, no, at no other time could you get more people to support you in a bid for office at any level. Right. And this is how the right wing has done it, from school board to judges. And again, in Pennsylvania this year, you're going to be electing the people who actually help run the elections at the local level.
Well,
the people who will be cited what happens about voter ID. And so I think these are real opportunities to make a difference.
Fair enough. And in many ways, the voter ID was legislated and put to rest just a couple of years ago. But to you, King, and I'm also thinking, based on what Becky just said, about what the Tea Party was able to do. I mean, talking about public events where, I mean, some of them were frightening and incendiary, but nonetheless, they got a lot of attention. They got elected to Congress, some of them. They forced the Republican Party to behave in a certain kind of way, especially in the House of Representatives. John Boehner probably lost his job because of them. Is there a message there?
Well, I think one of the differences is a way that it was described to me is that the Republicans fear their base and the Democrats hate theirs, meaning that for the Democrats, I think that there is such a kind of almost arrogance about the way in which they have locked up the black vote, locked up the Latino vote, locked up so many of votes of who we consider to be the constituency of the Democratic Party, that there's no need to appeal to us because there's always the kind of Neanderthal behavior of the Republicans that discipline the base of the Democratic Party, that if the protests get too loud, they point to Donald Trump, or they point to, you know, the sort of cabal of racist rogues and reactionaries in that party and saying, at least we're not them. And it's been very effective because there's nothing really electorally to the left of the Democrats, whereas the Republicans have a different relationship to their base. And so I'm not sure that the Tea Party metaphor exists. I think that if we look back historically in the 1930s and the 1960s, when the Democratic Party got its reputation as the party of the people, as the Democratic Party, it came in periods of massive social upheaval, massive social movements. And I think that after lulls within that type of activism, we often try to convince ourselves that, well, there must be another way. There must be some kind of shortcut. But there really isn't. We have to have, in effect, a people's lobby, which is a mass movement of the likes that we saw over the weekend, where you saw Democratic Party members all over that trying to sort of adapt to that mood. And so that really is the strength that we have.
Well, to be continued, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Kienga Yamada-Taylor, thanks for coming into our studios.
Thank you.
And Biggie Bond, thanks for joining us by telephone.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And also thanks to Emily Cooper Morse, who began our conversation. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download a podcast of the program. Also how to find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thanks for joining us in this First Hour Radio Times.